I'm going to call the Programs, Projects, and Operations Subcommittee to order. Before we begin tonight's agenda, I'd like to call on Director Fowler to recognize the significance of today's date.
Thank you, Director Conley. On this somber day, you know, we all were affected 17 years ago, family, friends. Seems like we all were as a nation. Myself, my brother was in the Pentagon, and his area was hit, but graciously, he was on the other side at the time. So different people were affected, and we've lost so much. But we should be always remember and be reminded of this great nation and what we stand for, because we still fight the same battles as we did back then. They're still out there. Just a moment of silence just to think about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Moving ahead now to, I'm calling the meeting to order. A copy of the Open Meeting Act is posted to the back of the room. Tonight we have two absences of directors, and Director Bradley and Director...
I'm right here.
Director Bradley is filling in for one, and Director Fowler is filling in for the other. And with that, quorum call, please.
Here.
Luke?
Here.
Bradley?
Here.
Fowler?
Here.
Yes. Next item is the adoption of the agenda.
So move.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Luke?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Fowler?
Aye.
Yes, I have here an affidavit of proof of publication of tonight's meeting. That'll become part of the permanent records. And now moving to item six is a presentation on the Platte Elkhorn River Integrated Monitoring Project Study. Paul Woodward and Chris Hobza.
Good evening. Tonight we've had this ongoing study for a couple years, collecting data and doing research. Graciously, the study was funded by the Water Sustainability Fund and some additional funds from DNR, and we cost-shared on part of the study with Lower Platte North. But Chris tonight's going to go over the update of where we're at. We're kind of moving from the end of monitoring and collecting information to actually putting everything together into some conclusions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
All right. First of all, thanks for having me out here. Been working on this project with Paul for not quite 2 years now. Basically, it's the Platte and Elkhorn River Valley Integrated Water Monitoring, where we're actually looking at groundwater surface water exchange between the Platte River and how groundwater moves from the Platte River towards the Elkhorn River in an area south of Fremont, Nebraska. So it's been a while since I've come and actually kind of talked to the board about this project, so I'm going to kind of go back into some background and some of the motivation for the study. I'm going to talk about the hydrologic conditions that we encountered starting back in June of 2016 and August through August of 2018, so just kind of leading up through today. And also the idea we're going to be looking at is the groundwater discharge or the flux to the Elkhorn River south of Arlington and from Arlington to the confluence. We use a set of methods to kind of characterize that that movement of water during what we're calling a low groundwater demand period. So that's kind of fall, winter, and spring, so September through May. And then there's some methods that we use to characterize, that movement of groundwater through the what we call a high groundwater demand period, which is going to be June, July, and August, which is when people are generally irrigating with crops. So we'll kind of wrap everything up with what did we learn and where do we go from there. So the background and the motivation for this particular project, this kind of started as part of a joint effort from this Lower Platte River Basin-wide management plan, which is seven different NRDs, including the Papio NRD, coming up with a new plan to kind of sustainably manage and conjunctively manage groundwater and surface water for water supply. One of the strategies that was kind of kicked around through some of these meetings was the temporary storage of water in the upper reaches. So kind of holding back water when we have periods of, say, higher than normal flow, and they're releasing that water downstream to kind of supplement low flow conditions where you might run into some water supply conditions, especially during drought periods. So for any of those kind of management strategies to be effective, we really need to understand the groundwater surface water interaction throughout our entire system, particularly when we get to down towards the east where we have some of our larger municipal well fields. So understanding those water supply availability is important. I think everyone here is well aware that groundwater surface water is exchanged. So our rivers and aquifers are hydrologically connected. I think everyone here is pretty well aware of that. But just to kind of go over one more time, you know, the Platte and Elkhorn River, they are hydrologically connected with their underlying alluvial aquifers. And depending on flow conditions, we can either have gaining streams, which we see on the left, where we have our water table surface is higher than our stream surface. In this particular case, water moves from the aquifer into the stream. That's a situation we have groundwater discharge. As we move downstream, that stream gains stream flow. Or we have a situation on the right where we have the water table surface is going to be at a lower elevation than our stream level. You have water moving from the river into the underlying aquifer. That's a situation that we call groundwater recharge. And as you move downstream, we actually lose stream flow. We'll see examples of both in some of the data here. And depending on, you know, the flow conditions, we could be able to be gaining or losing in the Platte and the Elkhorn River. So here, look at our study area. As I mentioned before, we're looking at an area that's so here's Fremont, Nebraska. Here's the Platte River. Kind of this doesn't really show up that well, but here's this kind of triangular piece of ground right here, downstream from Arlington all the way down to the confluence here. We have a stream gauge, USGS stream gauge here at La Chera, which is going to be a green triangle here, and we got our a stream gauge here at Waterloo. And these red dots that we're seeing there that kind of roughly delineate a transect between those two points. Those are some areas where we have some monitoring wells set up. They're collecting continuous water level data, and this transect is roughly coincides with the kind of local groundwater flow direction too. So we'll kind of look at some information regarding that. What's kind of interesting about this area, so the Platte River, it's connected to this underlying aquifer, and the elevation of the Platte is about 1,149 feet above sea level. Everyone here, I'm sure, has been in this area of like Valley, Nebraska. It's generally pretty flat as far as we can tell, but it's kind of gently sloping to the east. The water level surface elevation of the Elkhorn River is 1,110 feet. So it could be kind of a situation where water moves, the groundwater system moves from the Platte River kind of downslope to the Elkhorn River. So this is an area that you might have heard people say before, the Platte, this is losing reach of the Platte. Well, this is kind of part of that reason. We got this kind of natural movement of west-east of the groundwater system. So that's one of the things we're studying for this study. So some of the methods that we use the look at some continuous water level data and stream flow data. And we'll go over some of that. As I mentioned before, there's some methods we use to kind of characterize that water movement during low groundwater demand. We did a synoptic stream flow and water level survey. We took kind of a really comprehensive look at our entire study area and looked at water levels and stream flows. We also contracted a aerial thermal infrared mapping of a 10-mile reach of the Elkhorn River. We mapped surface stream temperatures right where the river froze up for the winter. And any of those kind of areas where you get groundwater seepage, you'll see some warmer temperatures. I'll show you some of that data later. And then we also kind of did some things to characterize the high groundwater demand or the summer months. We repeated that same synoptic stream flow and water level survey, and we did some temperature-based stream bed flux measurements. So we collected some temperature data in the stream bed to see how much water is moving into the Elkhorn. So here's a look at our stream flow conditions for the entire duration of this project. So this top graph is going to be in the Elkhorn River. So we can see there's our time here from starting from the beginning of the project up through nearly last week. This gold-colored line is going to be our average based on 89 years of record at Waterloo. And this blue line is going to be actually what was measured during that time period. So we can see that, you know, throughout the entire duration of this project, we've had way, way, much, much higher than normal stream flows with it across the entire Elkhorn River, which is kind of unique, but this is kind of the conditions that we had to do this project with. And then I'm going to repeat that same graph down below, and it's going to be the Platte River of Shara. So this gold-colored line, that's going to be your median daily discharge for 22 years of record. And you can see we had some, particularly early in the project, where we had higher than normal stream flows, indicated by this blue line. But for the most part, it was roughly tracking what that 22-year trend was. So those are the kind of conditions that we did this project with. I just want to highlight this is where we did the point in time where we did this low groundwater demand synoptic survey. So this would be early November of 2016. And here's our point in time when we did our high groundwater demand synoptic survey. So again, we had higher normal flows in the Elkhorn on both times and roughly about normal flows with the Platte River. But we're kind of coming out of a little bit of a dry period here in summer of 2017. So here's a look at our continuous water levels. So that transect of wells that I highlighted in that map, this is the water level data that's shown there. So here's our data on this bottom axis. Here's that water level and elevation in feet above sea level. And we can generally see that that groundwater moved from high elevation to the west to a low elevation to east. So the Platte River is going to be this pair of traces right here, and this gold color is going to be the Elkhorn River. And so generally what you can see is that these the relationship between the Platte and the Oakland remains fairly constant. You can see some of these periods of high precipitation events. Those are a lot more pronounced in the Elkhorn River, where you have these big jumps when you have you know, runoff conditions, wet weather, and some localized flooding, things like that. One thing I need to point out, there was an interesting situation that started early August. We had there was some construction going on. This well is just outside of left field in the Valley City baseball field. They had a number of wells that were put in for dewatering. They're doing some construction there. So Paul went out and checked it out, what was going on. We had a 5-foot drop in water. So this is kind of an anomaly that's it's almost recovered now. I looked at the data this morning, so you're scratching your head about that. So with those continuous water levels, there's something that we can do that's really useful to kind of quantify that groundwater flow and kind of put it in context and maybe some other things. One thing we can use is we can compute something called hydraulic gradient. And all that is it's effectively the slope of the water level surface. So if you remember slope from high school algebra. So basically it's that change in water level or that drop divided by the distance. And according to Darcy's law, which is kind of like the basic law that governs groundwater flow, any change in hydraulic gradient changes the amount of groundwater flow. So if you steepen your groundwater gradient, you know, you increase that slope, you're going to increase your groundwater flow. Hopefully that makes sense. Or if you kind of flatten that groundwater gradient, you're going to decrease your groundwater flow. And so it's kind of a multiplier or a factor in that equation. So we can use those measured water levels to assess the changes in water movement from the Platte to the Oakland. And so we're going to kind of talk a little bit about our synoptic water level surveys. I mentioned this a little bit before, but we kind of took a really comprehensive look at our entire study area. We looked at this low groundwater demand period where we collected water level data. You know, we found these streams that were connected to the groundwater system, sand pits, that type of thing. And we surveyed those water levels. We did takedowns and monitoring wells here and measured stream flow all across that study area. We picked up water levels from 32 wells. We surveyed in, you know, about 100 different surface water bodies like streams. There's a lot of sand pits, a lot of road ditches act like groundwater drains in that area. And we also did stream flow measurements and got some stream flows from a few different stream gauges as well. We kind of got a really kind of comprehensive look at the whole area. So as I mentioned before, one of the things we did was we computed that hydraulic gradient. And that's something you're seeing in this bottom trace here. So here's all that water level data we collected before, but here's going to be our trace of the hydraulic gradient. You can kind of see that's it's a relatively steady relationship. We see these big downward spikes, and those roughly coincide when we have those big runoff events in the Elkhorn River. So here's just kind of give you a point of reference or some context. This is going to be the point in time where we did that low groundwater demand synoptic survey. And then here's going to look where we did our high groundwater demand synoptic survey. Interestingly enough, we thought we were going to see this big difference in gradient, hydraulic gradient between these two surveys. We had drops in the Platte River and drops in the Elkhorn River between those two time periods. So what's the effect on hydraulic gradient? Well, it stayed roughly the same. It's kind of a coincidence or something. So we're going to dive in a little bit more detail on these flow conditions during this low groundwater demand period. So that's going to be your fall, winter, and spring. So here's a look at our entire study area here. And all these different dots indicate where we collected water level data. And what we did is we mapped the groundwater flow paths for this particular area. So what you're looking at here is a groundwater level or water level contour map. So basically you've got these lines of equal elevation. And so you got areas of high elevation and you got areas of low elevation as you move downstream. And how we look at and interpret this map is if you kind of have to imagine that you're a drop of water within this study area. So if I'm a drop of water right here, I'm going to move perpendicular straight downhill from all these different red contour lines. So if I'm right here, just north of Valley a little bit, I'm going to move perpendicular here, here, here. I'm going to turn towards Big Slough. I'm going to get captured by this little creek here, Big Slough, and I'm going to move downstream to the Elkhorn River and then kind of downstream off the page. And that's, you kind of pick any point within your study area, and that's kind of how you look at it and interpret it. Kind of give you the highlights. So we got this area to the north where we got these different creeks. So Big Slough, Rawhide Creek, this old channel, and then Rawhide Creek. All that groundwater moves towards those creeks, those little tributaries. So they act like little groundwater drains. To the southeast, that gradient kind of flattens out a little bit. And generally speaking, we got a thicker, coarser, sandier, a lot more sand and gravel aquifer in this area. Generally, that flow is pretty constant. It's moving straight southeast towards the Elkhorn River. And kind of based on what we saw with these measurements, the Platte River is losing across this entire reach. We got some water that's moving kind of on the western edge of this valley. It's going to probably ultimately make it back to the river. And off this east side, the water is generally moving towards the Elkhorn River as well. So here's a look at our stream flow measurements that we collected. So each one of these dots indicates the location where we collected stream flow data. And each one of these bold colored numbers or bolded numbers is the flow that we measured in cubic feet per second. You can kind of see that, generally speaking, these tributaries north are generally gaining stream flow. They're picking up groundwater, moving it east towards the Elkhorn River. One thing that we see here, we see a loss in this Rawhide Creek Old Channel here. That's because the city of Fremont, they have some dewatering wells here to the southeast part. They dump it in this creek, and so that water is kind of lost back to the groundwater system. Eventually, it gets gained back as it makes its way to the Elkhorn River. The Elkhorn River itself, we have our stream gauge here at Waterloo. We did 1610 and 1690, so this kind of this reach right here, we pick up additional 80 CFS in stream flow. And then we have this network of tributaries and road ditches and some other things that provide about 10.6 cubic feet per second. So there's a lot of water that's coming out of Two River State Rec area kind of over here and kind of being kind of just kind of routed back and forth and makes its way right there. We also did this, we contracted an aerial thermal infrared mapping project or a flight about 10 miles of the Elkhorn River. Basically what this does is that we can identify areas of where groundwater is coming into the river. So we collect this data when the river is pretty much icing up. You know, we know that groundwater is about 50, 55, 57 degrees Fahrenheit. We have this big temperature difference, and then anything that we can see, we can map it, map the temperature difference, and we can identify where areas where groundwater is coming into the river. So it's kind of nice in the fact that we can collect this from a manned aircraft. We collect one little, 10-mile reach in a really short amount of time. It's pretty rapid data collection and pretty cost-effective for what we get out of it. So here's a look at our reach here. So here's our Waterloo stream gauge up here. And we're going to go downstream. Here's Q Street. There's Center Street and Dodge Street, et cetera. So here's our 10-mile reach. We collected this, I mentioned before, part of the onset of ice. So river's about ready to ice up. The data we got back from the contractor, it's something called a raster grid. But basically, you can kind of imagine this kind of area on the river and near the river is like a checkerboard. And each square on that checkerboard is a half meter by a half meter. And each square on that checkerboard has its own temperature. So basically, it's just kind of a checkerboard of just temperatures, and each has its own unique value. We got those unique values. We did some, the contractor did some calibration as well. We used some self-logging temperature sensors that kind of ground truth that data. So here's a look at some of those temperatures. So we're gonna see this. We have a color ramp set up. So these kind of bluer colors, that's going to be colder. So that goes from 33 to 34 degrees, and our warmer reds, that's going to be 39, about 39 degrees. So those blues and those greens are going to be our cooler temperatures. And so basically you can kind of see as we move downstream, we get to Dodge Street, and we get that river warms up quite a bit and continues that way past Q Street. Generally what that means is we got additional warmer groundwater entering the stream. And we kind of think about the results we got from our synoptic water level survey. That regional groundwater flow direction is moving this direction. So as that river kind of goes from southeast and turns southwest, it's basically going perpendicular to that regional groundwater flow path, and it's picking up additional groundwater just by virtue of the fact that that's just the way the river turns. So anyways, any gains that we see in flow, generally it's going to be kind of concentrated south of Dodge Street. So here's another way to kind of look at that same information. So we have a graph here. So there's our down distance. So the zero is going to be Waterloo, and you're going to go down here to Q Street. We got temperature on this axis, so colder temps, warmer temps up top. But you kind of see there's an offset in those temperatures, and that's where that showed up in that color range. So that's going to be an increase in stream flow, increasing because we have additional groundwater discharge. And basically what we can do with that information, we can kind of just do some, like a real simple mixing calculation. We know the stream flow at Waterloo. We know the temperature at Waterloo. We know the temperature of groundwater in the system, and we also know the temperature at Q Street. And so we can do a little bit of algebra, rearrange our equation, and we can kind of figure out how much groundwater we're getting in that reach as well. So ultimately, we arrived at 43 cubic feet per second, about 2% of our total stream flow. And that's all concentrated between Dodge and Q Street there. So we're going to kind of transition and go to our high groundwater demand period, which is going to be during our summer months. Again, we repeat that same synoptic water level survey. And we remap these contours and kind of figure out our flow path. So again, kind of imagine you're a drop of water anywhere on the graph that you'd like to be, and you're going to move perpendicular to all those different red lines. By and large, this area to the north didn't really change all that much. Those water levels are a little bit lower. The stream flows are a little bit lower. But all those flow directions were pretty consistent compared to fall of 2016. What was really interesting was this area to the south, when we get towards that confluence. Instead of moving all southeast towards the Elkhorn River, things kind of shifted and went straight south, down towards the confluence with the Platte River. So that's going to have some interesting effects on the actual stream flow, which we'll see here. So in August 2017, these are the stream flows that we measured. Again, these, we have these tributaries up to the north. They're have a little bit less flow. There's people pumping groundwater. You know, the trees are, you know, using ET and the crops as well. So we have less stream flows up here in the north. But by and large, we're seeing that everything's gaining as you go downstream. We're picking up flow between Arlington and Waterloo. But what's really interesting is between Waterloo and Q Street, we're actually losing flow. And we're also going to look at this tributary just to the west off Q Street. It went from 10.6 CFS to 0.6. So basically what we've decided, or our interpretation is, as that water level flow direction shifted to the south instead of going southeast, that gradient kind of steepened, and what we're seeing is underflow. We have some water that's going in the stream bed, moving in the subsurface, and ultimately it's going to be intercepted by the plat downstream a little bit. So that 80 CFS loss that we saw, that was something that when the guys went out and measured, our stream gators went out and measured, and they got the results back, I'm like, this isn't right. We know for a fact that groundwater is moving from this way to that way. So they went back out a week later. Yeah, two guys each made their own set of measurements, and they largely replicated the same results. So we're really confident that we have this as an area of loss during certain very specific hydrologic conditions. And so we did come up with a number of groundwater flow estimates for high and low groundwater demand periods. And these results are going to be given in acre feet per year. So kind of be thinking about that as a kind of a volume of water over the course of an entire year. So we had characterized two different reaches, the Waterloo reach. We've got quite a bit of water coming in through the subsurface. Our tributary flow between these two time periods is about a quarter of that we see in the subsurface, but largely it's pretty consistent when you go from that high groundwater demand to that low groundwater demand. And we're going to shift gears. We're going to go down this Waterloo to Q Street. For the set of conditions that we measured during the high groundwater demand, we actually saw a minus 58,000 acre-feet per year loss across that entire reach, whereas we saw just the opposite during our low groundwater demand period. Tributary flow during the high groundwater demand period is quite low when you compare it to that low groundwater demand period. We got a big difference in tributary flow between those two time periods. And our aerial preliminary infrared mapping, worked out pretty well with our stream flow measurements, but it generally indicated that most of that flow is going to be concentrated between Dodge Street and Q Street as well. So kind of wrapping everything up, kind of what did we learn? You know, the Elkhorn River during our entire period study, the flow was well above normal. The Platte River was near normal for our entire period of study. That kind of we characterized a very kind of specific set of hydrologic conditions. That north section, so everything kind of north of Waterloo going up towards Arlington, really consistent groundwater and tributary flow, regardless of that high or low groundwater demand period. And that southern section is a lot more sensitive to groundwater demand and flow conditions, primarily of the Platte River and the Elkhorn River as well. So looking ahead, kind of taking all this information, we got a really good data set. We have a really good conceptual understanding of how this kind of system works. Moving forward, a numerical groundwater model can, reconcile the different flow patterns and conditions. And really, we could provide more of a calibrated estimate of groundwater flow from the Platte to the Elkhorn River at different times, different conditions. So we could look at areas of anomalously high, really high flows in the Platte, like we saw in 2013 with all that flooding on the Front Range, or at times of prolonged drought. So you can kind of play some of those what-if scenarios. Also, additional modeling would improve the understanding that the effect of varying flow conditions, like I mentioned before, prolonged drought, and also help understand the timing of movement of water from the Platte towards the Elkhorn.
I just wanted to mention a couple of things there. So as far as go back to that slide,
sure.
Just where are we going to take this information and go with it? I think one of the major questions was to kind of put some numbers to how much we think flow is moving where in different parts of this whole system between the Platte and the Elkhorn River. I think one of the things that you showed, because the Elkhorn River was high during our study, maybe that's why we saw some of those groundwater losses at times, because the Elkhorn River is just higher. The other thing we didn't quite see is this pulse come down the Platte where we could actually see, without any rain occurring over the valley, could we actually see this pulse of water that comes out of the Platte start to kind of move across the valley in the groundwater system and make it to the Elkhorn River. I think the study showed that the timing is fairly short, because one of our ideas was, if this timing is a long period of time, does water come down in the spring on the Platte River, kind of hang out in our groundwater between the two rivers, and then eventually go into the Elkhorn? Well, it's not quite that long. It's not providing water. It doesn't come down in May and still provide water in late July, the Elkhorn River. But if we ever get that chance where we're monitoring a pulse coming down the Platte with no rain occurring, that's telling us anything differently. We can kind of see how long, you know, maybe it's just a day or two for water to, for discharge to actually change into the Elkhorn River. So I think we were able to answer quite a bit about the quantity and where things are going. We still may have some questions about the timing. And then long-term, what this might lead to. I mean, most of you are familiar with the larger like groundwater augmentation projects that the Republican has done or have been done in the Platte River. You know, I don't know for our drought contingency planning type of thing if there's if there's groundwater somewhere in the middle between the two rivers here, like Fremont dewaters. They don't want that water there. It's just too high. If there's areas where we can take that water when it's potentially high or there during the middle of a drought, send it down one of those creeks to the Elkhorn River, knowing that it's going to recharge itself when the rivers come back up, there might be an opportunity to find kind of find a project there that could help us during a drought. So that's kind of the what we might do with it when we're all kind of said and done. So I'll let Chris wrap up and then see if we have any questions.
No, that's all I got.
Okay.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. You don't have any questions for these two?
I just had one little question. The Fremont discharge, is that enough to actually make a difference?
Difference in the...
The groundwater level in the Elkhorn River, for instance. You're talking about the Fremont actually discharges their own water because too high. How much do they discharge?
I mean, it's... It would be like an acre feet per year. It's you know, probably 20,000 acre feet per year. I mean, it's... It provides quite a bit of flow. I mean, it's probably 25-40% of the flow that's picked up between Arlington and Waterloo.
Comes from
just that Rawhide Creek Old Channel. Okay. So it's quite a bit of water, but I don't know what the change in water level would be. I guess I can't tell you right off the bat.
Okay.
But, you know, 30 CFS, that's a pretty good amount of water. I mean, that's, what would that be like? Couple, 1 or 2% of the total flow from that one tributary. So.
Okay, thank you.
Director Bradley?
Yes, I just had two questions /points. I was wondering about on the aerial infrared, that wasn't remote sensing then? That was...
It's a kind of remote sensing, yeah.
Okay. And who contracted that out to who?
It was Cornerstone Mapping. It's Aaron Shepherds. He's based in Lincoln. We did a bunch of work in the Loup River Basin. We used him before. And, it's pretty, he kind of know exactly what he wants. And it's, you know, a really short jaunt from his shop to over to the Elkhorn River. It's worked out pretty well.
Good. Instead of a camera actually taking pictures, it's taking temperature readings.
Oh, yes, sending a signature down and get that, in which I was wanting to know about the water temp, surface, subsurface. You're saying it increases south of Dodge, and I found that sort of interesting. And did you have the explanation why?
So basically the river, so if you go, I might just back up slides if you don't mind. So the river is running kind of, you know, from Waterloo here to Dodge, it's running southeast. Running flowing southeast, and that's almost parallel to that regional groundwater flow direction. So at Dodge, it turns and kind of turns back towards the west, and so it's now running perpendicular to that flow direction. And so basically, your effective surface area or your cross sectional area you're receiving that water is increasing. Does that kind of make sense?
It does now. It does now.
So getting us. I mean, this is a pretty slight increase in water temperature, but it's there. It's real. So, and that's just owing to the fact that river. It's just changing course a little bit.
Me and you hypothesize things and hearing from some of the elders that their tap water isn't as cold as it used to be, and just wondering if that's globally, if that's happening, and if you have these different studies, people putting it together, and is that data or evidence of global warming?
I mean, long-term it could be because, you know, your groundwater temperature is going to be reflective of your seasonal annual temperature. But what happens when you turn on your tap, it runs through all these different pipes, and you're not really getting a really good, unbiased measurement or sample. We get water temperature, we collect water samples, we get water temperature data, but it's, you know, generally going up through tubing and things like that. If it's a really hot day, it can be affected slightly by that. So it's maybe take that with a grain of salt. It's better to probably have some sort of probe or sensor in a well or something like that that's not being pumped, you know, and they're not measuring at the surface.
Well, let's add that.
I've got a question for you regarding the flows from the Loup River. They're, you know, they generate power and the flows go up and then they shut off and flows go down. How did that impact your studies?
So one thing that I did, so that we have that this hydrograph here, I didn't do like the we generally collect 15 minute data. Every 15 minutes we collect a water level. And you would see that cycling on this, this can be an orange trace here, this Platte River trace. Kind of take that out of the equation and just kind of look at more, I guess, what's actually like kind of more of a bigger picture, I guess. I took that kind of out of there and I just did just the daily median flow. So you're not going to see that cycling from there. You would see it in this blue well, which is going to be on the, you know, west of La Chera. This is going to be actually in the lower Platte North NRD. You would see that daily cycling, you know, really, really kind of dampened. And you'd see it in this La Chera well, which is just at the east. We just did kind of daily values for that particular graph. To kind of take that.
Thank you.
And as we went across the valley, you don't see that oscillating occurring quite so much. It's kind of dampened itself out.
And yeah, the Valley Park well doesn't show anything. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you both for the presentation this evening. The next item is item 7, is review and recommendation on the Little Papillion Creek Channel Stabilization Mercy 10R Project. Martin Cleveland.
Thank you, gentlemen, directors. Joining me tonight is Pat Engelberg with HDR Engineering, the firm that designed this project and is handling the construction administration for us. Let's go first to the map. Bill, it's in the sequence of slides near the back of that little patio. I'm going to get you familiar with where we're at first. It's in the handouts. It's the map. Okay. Anyway, this project is located north of Mercy Road. It's in the Exarban area. It's across from, it's adjacent to College St. Mary. On the map. We bid this project back in July, actually in June, I guess, and the board considered the bids in July. At that time, the low bidder was roughly $900,000, I guess, which was a lot more than we budgeted for the project and also a lot more than we thought the project was actually worth. So we had to go back and look at the project, try to see if we could make the project more economical. You know, if there's some way we could change the sequencing of the construction or something else that would help the effort save some costs. Here's again the map. Mercy Road is out the bottom end of the map. North is going this direction. This is College of St. Mary. Again, the creek is this location. The area of question is right here. And if you go to the next photograph, Bill, I know you've all seen this before, but very bottom of this slough area. We call this a slough. It's basically a slide of the channel embankment, which is a 2-to-1 slope normally. There's actually material piping out into the creek due to artesian pressures in the coming out of the slope of the creek bank. So the intent of this project is to try to stabilize the slope as well as stop this fan boil activity, which is basically over time is undermining the slope and taking material into the creek. And so go back to the memo, if you could, Bill, at the very front end. So we opened bids in August for this project and ranged from $298,383 to $374,225. The engineer's estimate was $351,475. The low bidder was Valley Corporation at $289,383, which is, as you can see, is about a third of what we had for bid in June. So obviously, the changes that HDR recommended, we went with, made a big difference in terms of generating, we thought, reasonable cost for this project. Pat may have some comments to add to this, because everyone's, of course, designed the project. What they did differently, I guess, maybe you can explain that to the board.
Yeah, so a couple things that we did differently from the first time we bid it to the second time is we modified the installation method of the well, went with more conventional installation methods. which I think gave the contractors a little more confidence that they could install these properly. The second thing we did had to do with schedule. Initially, we thought, you know, we wanted them to get it done within 3 weeks, substantial completion, because given the artesian pressures and the instabilities that exist out there, once they started, we wanted them to complete it. Now that we were a little farther in the fall, we felt a little more confident with maybe some lower water levels that we could give them a six-week window to get to substantial completion, and then with a couple weeks to finish with topsoiling, et cetera. And then the last thing we did, we actually increased the amount of time from the pre-bid meeting until bid opening to give them an opportunity to reach out to subcontractors. And we think a combination of those three things really helped hone our bid in quite a bit.
We're still using 9 mini relief wells. They're being placed roughly 2 feet or so above water.
Yes.
At the top of these wells. And there's also sheet pile along the edge of the creek between the wells and the water, and then also riprafs being placed. So there's kind of a combination of those three things going on. But basically, the wells are there to relieve that pressure that's making this slope unstable to start with. And the sheet piles to keep the toe of that slope where it's at, so it doesn't move out, and also protect the wells from being undermined at some point by erosion on the creek. So those three things together kind of serve as a project. HDR did provide a recommendation letter, and it's included in the packet, and that did indicate the approval of Valley Corporation. And Valley Corporation has worked for the district in the past. As an example, Drinsky Base Number 2, they're working on right now near West Center Road and 204th Street, as well as the West Packet Trail near Millard. They're working on that project for the district. So they're engaged in 2 active projects today with us, and worked in the past, and are very confident contract we feel that they can do a good job with this project. So be happy to answer any questions you have regarding this.
I'd like to get a motion on the floor.
Recommendation.
Thank you, Fred.
Second.
Thank you, Director. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, directors? Seeing none, roll call, please.
Yes.
Keller?
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat.
Are we gonna have, I got one question as you're done. Are we going to have any more of these spots developed?
You know, the potential does exist. And as we talked about, I think, at the July meeting, there is one up by the furniture mart that they're still trying to arrest. And that reared its ugly head probably 30 years ago. This one showed up probably 3 years ago.
About 15 years ago. I was on the board.
Or you on the panel? they've been wrestling with that one for a while. The possibility does exist for another sand well.
I think probably the creek's degrading over time that has lowered this or made this confining layer thinner, which means they can't resist artesian pressure. So it probably is a realistic thing to expect. So it's good to get this under a belt, see if it works, and if it does, then we can do it, replicate in other places.
And it's kind of critical to get it in its early phases of that development. Once it gets a little bit too large, you've got to employ a little bit different tactics.
We've spent about over $2 million in their efforts so far, so it's a big effort up there.
Thank you, gentlemen. Next is Martin Cleveland again. An interlocal cooperation agreement with Sarpy County for 168th Street Bridge, number 147 project at Chalco Hills Recreation Area.
Thank you. With me tonight I have Bill Herr. He's the administrator with the Public Works Department of Sarpy County. We go to the map first. It's the very last map on the sequence, the colored map. I don't know why you can see this. It doesn't always show up so well on the screens, but 370 is at the very top end of the screen. This is I-80, runs down towards Lincoln. This is 168th Street, and Chocolate Hills, south of 370 is this area. It's kind of like a triangle somewhat, defined by this, basically row of trees, essentially. And so this road project is from basically from here down to here, and it consists of turning an existing gravel road into a three-lane rural paved road, and replacing a substandard bridge here that's fracture critical, is the description, Pony Trace Bridge. And so By doing that, it's much like Giles Road project that was built here a couple years ago. In order to do that, they have to need a bigger cross-section, a bigger area to build a project, and that means taking right-of-way off of both sides of the road alignment. And on the Chapel Hill side, there are some things impacted and things they have to do on the Chapel Hill side. Again, the Chapel Hills recreation area is land that's owned by the USA government. District has a lease on it, so we're a partner to it, and that's why there's a interlocal agreement between the county and the NRD proposed here, because they have to come to us to get their approval, basically, to do this work, but they also have to get approval from USA and the Corps of Engineers as well, because they actually own the property. We have a lease for it. We go back to the memo, Bill, the first page, kind of walk you through what this agreement consists of. Really, the four things are right here. We're going to install a culvert and widened ditch on the east side of the street, which would be on the Chalk Hills property, at least partially on the property. We're going to wipe the course of the roadway embankment, the three-lane section. This, by the way, this road does go down to Stram Road, I guess. That's where it ties into. And that will someday be a major road across Harper County, I'm sure, with time, paved, so forth. Also, reconfiguring filled area entrances into Chapel Hills Recreation Area. So there's some entrances we use to get into the park. They're going to redo those, reconfigure it to fit the road, and also construct embankment along the east side of the street for future MOPAC trail, which has always been envisioned basically through that area south, 370, nicked into Stram Road, then going back to 144th Street. So this is kind of the final link that hasn't been built yet, but so they'll actually build that embankment for future trail. They won't build the trail, but they'll build the embankment. So that's kind of a short summary. I might see if Bill wants to add some things to this, because he's actually the project manager, and maybe I haven't missed, I missed a few things in describing this project to you.
No, I think you did very well.
Okay. So again, it's an agreement to allow them to do some things on property the district actually leases. And so happy to answer any question, or Bill can help answer questions too.
I move a staff recommendation.
Second. We have a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, directors? I'd like to comment. I think this is a great area of cooperation here to help get this project done and help us get that trail through there. That's been a long-term goal, and I'm glad to see this happen.
Glad to do it.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, roll call, please.
Caller?
Yes.
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 Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill.
Next, we have Amanda Grant. This is purchase of the principal spillway and drawdown pipe for WP6 and WP7.
Thank you. Hello, and Mike Sotak, Fire Engineering, is here as well to help answer any questions or clarify. But as an update, it seems like a long time coming, but we did just recently put out the invitation for bids for WP 6 and 7, two flood control reservoirs in Papillion. We started Prairie Queen at the same time of year. We guess we like that added pressure of having to get that first phase of grading in before the weather turns back. Because when we start in October, or we would have construction bids for you to consider in October. So assuming that that all goes well and you approve a construction contract, it would be November when they start work, and you know the weather gets a little iffy around December. And we really want that done prior to the winter shutdown, because we have a long settlement period because of the soils there. And so we'd like to get that first lift done, especially important at WP6 because there's some iffy soils there. So the recommendation that we have is to go ahead and put in a purchase for the principal spillway pipe and the temporary drawdown pipe, because those are the first things that will be needed to get that first phase of grading done. And historically, there's kind of been some lead time issues with that pipe in the area. The first pipe we're going to talk about is the principal spillway pipe, and it's really just got one manufacturer. It's kind of the sole source item because they bought their competitor recently, I guess, and so that's just kind of who it is. And we've used that pipe. Just if you remember, we did some rerouting of sanitary sewer with the city of Gretna around what will be WP2, and that's that same pipe that's going in there, and used it at other projects as well. So, and we would not, when we, as this is out to bid, the material costs, you know, they would obviously not be bidding on that. The material would be on site, and then they would just be bidding the installation. And then the second type of pipe is the HDPE, the temporary drawdown pipe. And that one is not sole sourced. However, pretty much every project around has been getting that from this ISCO products, and we assume that would be where the contractor that bids on our project would get that from. And so our recommendation for you this evening is to waive the district policy on competitive bidding because one is sole source and one is not necessarily sole source. So we'd have to waive the competitive bidding policy, but go ahead and order that pipe ahead of time just to give us those few extra weeks that may become critical on the back end of this when the weather. Mike can answer any questions if you have any pipe or timing.
Let's get a motion on the floor first, if we could.
I'll motion for staff recommendation.
Second. We have a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, now let's ask questions. Director, Chad?
The 265-800, is that relatively competitive in that regard, the number?
Well,
there's no other bid, so.
It's the only number.
I mean, what are we comparing it to?
It's in line with what we've seen recently. They did buy the competitor in about the last year and a half, and they don't seem to be gouging anybody at this point. I think they, in talking to them about the availability pipe and the getting it up here, they recognize the entity as a good partner and you know, a great purchaser of their materials. So I think they're treating us fair. $511 a linear foot is about what we've seen for 48-inch
diameter pressure pipe. That's pretty normal then?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mike, could you explain why polyethylene is used for the drawdown?
Sure. So this drawdown is a little bit unique in that we're you know, we have a normal drawdown pipe that goes through the dam that exits into the riser, but at WP6, because of the potentially really long settlement times there, we put in another additional low flow drawdown in the creek channel basically, and the idea is we're going to use that to build the first two phases of the project, and then once we get in the regular spillway pipe, we're going to grout it shut. So it's a bit unique in that we've got the additional, what we call a low-level drawdown, and eventually we're just going to ground it shut. So basically what it is, it's relieving risk for the contractor to, A, have the reservoir flooded out too often by putting this in. It just can keep draining. And, B, it also reduces the risk of having a kind of a half-built high-hazard dam sitting there for a period of several months. So all in all, and I want to point out that due to the timing of getting this information out to all of you, that $100,000 is actually about $50,000. We weren't sure exactly on the cost of that, but anyway, that $100,000 is about $50,000. So it's a bit of a unique approach to this. We want to keep the water level down. We're getting a lot of borrow out of the pool area WP6, so this is going to allow the contractor to get in there and ultimately, I think, reduce your overall costs and then not having to deal with water. We compared pumping. We compared a lot of different do-nothing. We compared several different alternatives and worked with staff and management to come up with a decision that seemed to be the best.
This is a nominal 12-inch then. It becomes throwaway, right?
I'm sorry?
This is nominal 12-inch pipe.
No, this is not 12-inch pipe. This is a 24.
Yeah.
24. So it's the value of this is it's the fused butt welded solid wall pipe, and so there's no joints.
Any other questions or comments? Director?
I've got a question. You know, are you that comfortable without having any other bidders on this that we're not going to come into a problem somewhere along the line here? It's my experience. I'd be scared to just throw it out there to a person just because I just feel that maybe we need to look a little bit for a competitive bid.
So the top pipe, we don't have any choice there. There's only one supplier in North America right now. On the bottom one,
All I can tell you is that we've used that pipe a lot recently, and not only some of the NRD projects for the levees, also for the lower Platte South NRD down in Lincoln on some dam rehabilitation projects. Nobody else has supplied pipe so far, so I don't think, first of all, people aren't going to come screaming to the NRD more than likely because you put out more construction projects than almost anybody, you know, in this realm, and so I don't think anybody's going to complain. I don't think there's anybody to.
Well, and that's the reason why I would say that. I would rather see a competitive bid. Is for that reason, but you know, I mean, if you've only got one game in town,
yes, sir.
The game likes to change in the second quarter sometimes, and that's the only reason why I say it's just for a comfort zone. You know, just if I was going to build a house, I don't think I would just go with one guy to bid my house that I'm building, just because maybe that's all I could get for material.
Understood. The other thing is that this is one of the suppliers that has it in stock. And so we're up against, on the WP2 project, it took 8 weeks to get that pipe here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they waited until Greta waited until the project was awarded, notice of awards to the contractor. Once they got their bonds in shape, you know, in shape and actually ordered the pipe, it took 8 weeks, mm-hmm. So they sat around and waited. So this is the absolute first thing we need at site WP6 to start in that project. Nobody else that we've talked to has said that they've got it in stock, ready to ship here in time. So it's a bit of an unusual circumstance, I understand. But
is this all we need then, or once you buy this, we don't need any more?
So this is both principal spillways at site WP6 and WP7, and the low flow drawdown at WP.
Right.
So there are no other materials out there that would potentially hold up construction from us being able to construct phase one for the snowflakes.
I mean, we don't have to go back later on and buy more of this at a greatly inflated price because we've already bought everything we need at this price.
Correct.
In our normal procedure, it would be to let the contractor work out pipe prices and put that in their bid, but just in this case to have it here, that's why we're doing it.
A question for you. Why did you highlight the fact that this is solid wall pipe? What's solid wall pipe as opposed to what?
So HDP has several different products here. You know, you've seen some of the slip lining projects that we worked on where it's a real thin wall pipe. Mm-hmm. And so when we say solid wall, we're just kind of talking to the subsect of the pipe. HDP also makes what they call smooth flow pipe, where it's kind of corrugated on the outside and smooth on the inside for storm sewers. This is a heavy, very, you know, 152 feet of fill. And it just kind of describes the process as the solid wall water main pipe, basically.
Thank you.
In both these pipes, he did put it'll be taking all the bid specs, which saves us at least 10% markup from the general contractor. I agree with you. Competition is good, but in some cases, you know, that long time to take it. This would be a formal request for proposals with their IP, and so that might. And plus, we're going out for the construction bid, so. I don't know how much we'd save, and maybe you guys could
I
save.
I promise you're not going to stick that money somewhere else, Joe. Not
sure. See a hand down this way. Director Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, waiving competitive bid, what the legal counsel said.
And we can waive competitive bid.
Any other questions or comments? Roll call and motion, please.
Aye.
Yes.
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 Yes. Thank you all. I think we are concluded, aren't we not?
Yes, correct.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
Do we want to keep rolling? Do we want to take a 5-minute break?
All right.
Give staff a moment to
rearrange.
Call my name. I'm here.
And you're not. The time is 7:27. I'm calling to order the Finance, Expenditures, and Legal Subcommittee on September 11th, 2018. The notifications of the Open Meetings Act is placed on the back wall. With that, quorum call, please.
Bradley?
Here.
Tom
here.
Reese?
Here.
Fred Conley?
Here.
And Jefferson?
Here. And we do have an excused absence from Director Rich Teaser. Agenda item number 4, adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second. Motion and second. Roll call on the motion, please.
Second.
Yes.
Reese?
Here.
Fred Conley?
Aye.
Yes.
Yes. Agenda 5. I have an affidavit of proof of publication for this evening's meeting that will become part of the permanent record. Moving on to agenda item 6 is a review and recommendation of the adoption of the fiscal year 2019 budget and set property tax levy at 0.037594 for the fiscal year 2019 budget. General Manager John Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, if you could go down a little bit. The district received our final evaluations from the county clerk's offices, and the final numbers are listed up on the board. Bill, if you could go up, I guess. Sorry. As you can see, the lion's share of the increase was Sarpy and Douglas County. Actually, two of our counties lost valuation. We've seen a decrease in their overall valuation. Washington County was 0.5%, and then Dakota was about 3.5%. The tax levy, as stated in the opening agenda, would be set at 0.037594. This is a decrease from last year. The total tax requirement of $24,823,950 is an overall increase from last year of $1,097,509. If you look at the impact on the valuations of a $100,000 home in fiscal year 18 at 0.037797, it was $3,780. And for 150,000 home was 75.59. This year it would be 37.59 for a home valued at 100,000, or 75.18 for a home valued at 200,000. So if your valuation stayed the same, or if actually it decreased, then you would see a savings from the district in your yearly property tax bill this particular year. Again, the total operating budget was $72.2 million. If you go to the budget summary and the fact sheet on the third sheet, it lists out the flood control as far as what is spent, erosion control, water quality, recreation, forestry and wildlife, and the watershed fund. That's how we break down all the projects and programs in those major budget categories. If you look at the pie charts, it shows kind of the breakout of the proposed expenditures and the revenues. This historically, this has held true over the last few years, the last decade. Obviously, flood control watershed projects take the majority of the budget. If you look at the revenues, property taxes are only 30% of our, roughly 34% of our budget. And so that stays pretty consistent over probably the last, at least the last 12 years that I've been here. Cash on hand, 36%. Obviously, those funds are carried over from year to year, and they are the first pieces of the pie that get taken to fund any project or program for the fiscal year. Again, we do a fairly good job or a great job of getting state funds and federal funds and any local matches. We did have a few changes from the last budget. Obviously, our increase was 5.19%. And the items that we increased or that we added back are in yellow in your budget proposal or in your budget, the specific program sheets. I can just go over real quickly. We added $400,000 to Glacier Creek. We added 70. Let me go through. Glacier Creek's on page 29. Yeah, I'll have to go to that one first. 29, we added $400,000 to that. That's what we reduced it to get the original budget under the current mill levy. And then if you look on page, let me see, if you look on page 15 of 44, maintenance channels and levies, we added $15,000 back to account 4400, and we added $10,000 back to account 4479. And then the final change was Missouri River levy certification on page 13 of 44. We added in
consultation with legal counsel. We added $70,000 to the Missouri River Levy attorney's fees, and we'll have a discussion on that later on in this meet on this agenda as far as right-of-way acquisition. But we think we're going to have some issues with some right-of-way acquisition, and we may need some additional legal fees to iron those out before we can acquire those properties. So we added that back, so we were covered in that regard. So those are the only changes from the first draft. And so, again, we're 13 out of 14 years. We've kept the mill levy the same. We're actually decreased it. Again, we're decreasing it this year. And so we would recommend the approval of the budget and the approval of the levy setting at 0.037594. Nothing was added back. That was just we fixed a number there. So it was either an actual or and then we got a third estimate. So it didn't affect the overall budget.
Thank you, John.
So I'll ask any questions or answer any questions you have.
Can I get a motion on the table before we open?
I move with staff recommendation.
Director Bradley.
Second.
Seconded by Director John Conley. Any questions from the public? Staff or directors?
I just had a little thing I wanted to bring up. it looks like the tax actually went down for a house valued at $100,000 or $200,000, which technically is true. However, last year's house in Sarpy County was valued, the $200,000 house next year was valued at $186,500. So essentially, the house value went up 7.03%, and so did the taxes. So it makes it look like the tax they're paying went down when in fact it went up.
That's correct.
Same as Douglas.
So, yeah, if your valuation increases by whatever percent that is,
they're paying. Right. The $186,000, $500 house last year in Sharpe County is going to be worth $200,000 next year, and so they're actually paying more tax.
Right.
Than the people. That's just my point.
Thank you, Director Jeff. Further comments from directors? Seeing none, roll call on the motion.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And item number 7 is a review and recommendation on land acquisition for Grasky Crossing. Executive session for this?
No.
I'm going to hold this for another month. And just to give you a very quick update, there are just very minor issues, nothing major. However, they have an illness in their family, and they're only able to reply when they can have. Lined up with our deadlines, so no issues, but hopefully we'll be
right. Sorry. We've agreed upon the price, and so it was some minor things that they didn't have a chance to review.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, what is that land used for right now?
It's they use it they farm lease it, I believe, and so
farm ground.
Yeah, I don't even know what they grow, hay or I don't. Is it hay? Yeah, they hay it out, so it's not a row crop.
Is it a lot of work on our part to make it a parking lot?
No, it's very flat. It's the last flat piece in that area. So.
All right, with that, moving on to agenda item number 8, review and recommendation on land acquisition for West Papillion Regional Basin number 6. Amanda Grant.
I'll explain the offer that we have for you to consider this evening, and then if we need to go into some more details, we can go. Grant will stop any of us at any time, and we can go into executive session. This is really the last piece of land necessary for WP6, and it is currently owned by the Hogg family, but it has an agreement to be purchased by a developer, BHI Developer. Incorporated, BHI Properties Incorporated. So we have purchased land like this before. The agreement involves all three parties. We're actually would be purchasing from the Hogg family. However, BHI would be a signatory on the agreement because they're agreeing to let them sell us that parcel. And so the purchase agreement for your consideration tonight is 38.92 acres at the price that the BHI properties paid for the whole piece, which is $44,000 per acre. And the thing that I wanted to mention about this is there's 9 additional acres included in that 38 acres that were not necessary for the project. However, it leaves 9 acres for that family that's not very accessible. And for the developer also, that's not very usable because they don't own the land next to it. If at some point in time, whoever owns the land adjacent to that 9 acres, that's just kind of, it's just upland of what we need. If someone develops that, that would be useful to them at that point because that's where the access and everything would come from. So there's a potential that we could sell that back someday, like we did at Prairie Queen, if we want to. But the agreement tonight is just that we purchase it because as it sits right now, there's a totally different landowner to that adjacent piece. And so we just, there's this 9 acres kind of hanging out between Bloodpool and their property line that they and the developer cannot. So that's the situation. We are working on a final survey because of that additional piece that they can't use and we didn't necessarily need for the project. We're going to do a final survey, but we have 38.92 is pretty accurate. We're just going to finalize that before we come up with the number. So the estimated amount would be $1,712,480.
All right. Could I get a motion on the table?
I move approval of staff recommendation.
Second. Motion from Director John Conley and a second from Director Bradley. Any discussion from the public on this agenda item? Staff or directors? Director Weiss.
Bob, these prices are just staggering for ground. Mm-hmm.
This is actually
where are we getting these numbers?
What's that?
I recommend. All right. I move that we go into executive session. Yes. You have to roll call then. Yeah. Roll call for going into executive session to discuss the land acquisition for the West Papillion Regional Basin number 6.
Bradley?
Yes.
John Conley?
Yes.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes. I move that we move out of executive session regarding discussion of the land acquisition West regional basin number.
Second.
Motion is second to come out of executive session. I'll roll call on the motion.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Any further discussion can be had outside of it. Seeing none, roll call on the motion.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Amanda. Moving on to agenda item number 9, review and recommendation on land acquisition for Missouri River R-13 and R-16 levee improvement project, Paul Woodward. We would request we go into executive session. I move that we go into executive session to discuss the land acquisition for Missouri River R-15 and R-16 levee improvement project.
Second.
Motion is second to go into executive session for R-15 and R-16. Roll call on the motion, please.
Aye. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. All right, I move that we come out of executive session from discussing our levies, or levies land second. Acquisition for 6:15 and 6:16.
Second.
Bradley, roll call on the motion to come out of executive session.
Bradley?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes. With that, any further discussion from directors on the agenda item can be discussed publicly? Seeing none, roll call on the motion.
Well, hold on.
Wait, we need
one. Oh, we have two motions.
We have two motions. Okay. So Motion number one, Taylor and McCauley, R613, Track 14. Management recommends that the subcommittee recommend to the board that the general manager be authorized to execute a purchase agreement with Taylor and McCauley, a Nebraska general partnership, in the amount of $71,100 for an area containing 18.916 acres of land for the Missouri River R613, R616 levee improvement project, subject to such other terms and conditions as general manager determined necessary and desperate legal counsel approves as to form, and I so move.
Second.
Okay. Seconded by Director John Conley. Roll call on the motion, please.
John Conley?
Yes.
Reese?
Yes.
Brett Conley?
Bradley? Yes.
Dan?
Yes. Next motion for the Fox Creek Properties, LLC, R613, Track 27. Management recommends that the subcommittee recommend to the board of that the general manager be authorized to execute a purchase agreement with Fox Creek Properties, a Nebraska limited liability company, in the amount of $79,900 for an area containing 26.604 acres of land for the Missouri River R613, R616 levee improvement project, subject to such other terms and conditions as general manager determines necessary and district legal counsel approves as to form, and I so move.
Second.
Motion on the table. Any further discussion from directors? Roll call on the motion, please.
Yes.
Brett Conley?
Aye. Yes.
Conley?
Yes.
Yes. With that, I do believe we are adjourned.